Here we are. The day has come. The way this event was framed to the world was that it was about creativity. And maybe that's like too hand-wavy of a word. It's about art. And it started right with the invitations, where every journalist who was invited to the event got an invitation with a different Apple logo on it that was made by a different artist, presumably with a pencil on an iPad. And it was held at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, which made it an East Coast event, which is unusual. We were up early here in California to watch this thing.
It was pretty weird to wake up and actually just literally like start watching the event 20 minutes after I had got out of bed.
Yeah, it was weird. It was definitely not my usual morning routine. And my whole day feels strange now.
Same.
But it was really fun. It's like holiday for me whenever there's an Apple event. So, you know, I was very excited to see what was going on. And so was the crowd at this event. The crowd went nuts when Tim Cook came out on stage. I think that's amazing. I think that it's really cool that everybody was so excited for this event. And Tim obviously was too. In fact, everybody who went on stage pretty much sounded like they were really pumped. Maybe this is no surprise, but the Adobe employee that demoed Photoshop on the iPad sounded like she'd just won, a gold medal at the Olympics when she presented Photoshop for the iPad.
It's true.
Everybody's really psyched about this. And I think that the creativity theme, the art theme of this event really gets at why. Because something that struck me watching this event and watching all of the hardware that was announced framed through the lens of making stuff, creativity, is that increasingly Apple's demos of what you can do with this stuff are getting less computery, if that makes sense, and more real.
That's interesting.
The line between work you do on a computer, creative work you do on a computer, and stuff and in, you know, like normal human life activity. I don't know exactly how to put this, but maybe what I mean is it's getting less nerdy. Like, it's getting more normal to work in images or video or music or whatever media, you know, they're demonstrating at an event like this. Doing that kind of digital creative work is becoming more and more like a real world trade of some kind. And as the objects that the tools you use to make them become less abstract and more like real tools in your hand, it's starting to make it more human. Mm. And I sound like an Apple PR video right now. What I'm getting at here, I think, is that the reason people are so excited for an event like this, I think, has to do with the real impact on what they do every day that an event like this is going to have. And I think it's possible that that it has more meaning to people. An event like this has more meaning to people than an iPhone event, because I think increasingly an iPhone is an interruption, is a thing that you have to deal with. And so you want it to be nice, but it's not something that you sit down with intentionally to do something positive, to do something you want to do. The phone is for dealing with things you have to do. But the tools that Apple shows off in an event like this are for doing the things you want to do and the things you get to do. Hmm. So that excitement showed on everybody's face.
Even when I think about how they are marketing the phone, it is more of a camera than a phone.
Yeah.
In some ways at this point.
Good point.
Which is the main thing that many people do with the device. That is a totally creative act that is within their ability. And the iPad specifically, but all Apple devices are kind of now being pitched as these really amazing places for you to do whatever creative work you want to. And I do think that you're really hitting on something about how human that makes these programs. And not only are they not like demoing an Excel sheet, but I also feel like they're less and less interested in demoing products that like do the creative task for you. I remember a couple of years ago, the iPad event had had an app where like you would feed it a bunch of video that you took, and then it would like edit the video for you and cut it up and like make a cool, you know, little video about your vacation, which is boring to me because I would much rather control the edit of that video myself. And that doesn't seem to be their focus anymore. Like, it doesn't seem like they're wanting to showcase how it can like make creative tasks autonomous. It's how it can make creative tasks more human. And that's a distinction that really sets Apple apart and makes me love them.
Yeah. Like I said, it just sort of sounds like their typical pitch in a way, but it's coming true in a pretty remarkable way.
Okay, tell us about the Macs.
So the way that every announcement was framed today was in light of this theme of creativity. And the devices that Apple presented everything was presented in increasing order of excitingness, the way that things usually are. But they were all framed as Apple's most creative tools or something like that. I didn't have the exact quote about that. But when Tim went to the Mac first, as the first line they were going to talk about, he described it as the first computer that was designed for creativity, which I thought was a really nice way of referring to the Mac. You know, it refers to it as sort of a legacy thing. It's got that pedigree of having been designed from day one, 30 years ago, 30 plus years ago, for creativity. And he went through a few stats about the Mac. 100 million people use Macs now, which is pretty awesome. Adding 1.4 million every quarter on average for over 6 years. And 51% of Mac buyers are new to the Mac, which is pretty amazing for a PC industry that's in decline. He also pointed out that number in China is 76%. 76% of Mac buyers in China have never used a Mac before. There were two Macs announced today, both of which are existing products that were badly in need of a redesign. You might argue that one of them was only in need of a redesign if you actually want the computer, which is a much more questionable proposition. The other is the most popular Mac, which is the MacBook Air. And there have been rumors for a long time about a redesign of the MacBook Air to keep the thing alive. And that is a kind of strange idea at this time, as you pointed out quite rightly, because the MacBook Air has actually been squeezed from both ends by the Mac notebook line in the past few years. Mm-hmm. When they first announced in 2016, I believe it was, when the Touch Bar MacBook Pros first came out, they also announced a 13-inch MacBook Pro without Touch Bar that Phil Schiller at that event explicitly positioned as a successor to the MacBook Air. Like, I believe that he referred to that overtly, and it was a lot more expensive and the form factor was not quite the same. I mean, it was still very light, but then the footprint was more or less the same, but the display was much better and so forth. And they tried to sell that as the replacement for the MacBook Air on the high end, because the MacBook Air, the thing that was so wonderful about it, the reason why I used it from 2011 until 2017, when I got a second generation Touch Bar Mac, is because it was surprisingly powerful. It was an awesome computer in an incredibly efficient form factor. And, you know, the sacrifice was made on the display and things like that. But I dealt with that because the computer was good enough to do everything I needed it to do, and I could throw it in my backpack. Actually, they introduced the super slim, tiny MacBook, Retina MacBook, before this. And so first they squeezed the MacBook Air from the portability side by making a much smaller, much lighter, much cuter computer.
Right.
Though it was really expensive and it was super underpowered. So it didn't replace the MacBook Air in terms of price or performance, only in cuteness. And then they released this 13-inch MacBook Pro without Touch Bar, which certainly didn't replace it in terms of price and was trying to replace it in terms of performance, but it also didn't replace it in terms of thinness and lightness and portability. I mean, it wasn't that bad, but it wasn't that great either. So as you quite rightly posed in the middle of this introduction, where does the MacBook Air fit now? And the interesting thing was they've kept it alive this whole time and positioned it as the lowest end portable Mac, the most affordable portable Mac. And so I think the big question going into the reveal of the redesigned MacBook Air was, is it going to remain a low cost device? Is it going to remain the sub $1,000 Mac notebook? And spoiler alert, the answer is no. But I think the redesign that they revealed is really something. It's really, really special. And it's good enough that if I had a desktop Mac at home, this is absolutely a portable that I would consider if I haven't completely replaced portables with iPads by then, which I probably will have. But just saying, like, this is a very, very, very good MacBook Air in every way except price.
It is still the cheapest Mac, though. Cheaper than the MacBook.
It's cheaper than the MacBook, but it's starting at $1,200. And I think that's for 128 gigs of storage, which is like not enough.
The MacBook proper starts at 13, so it's $100 less. It's nothing massive.
Right.
But I guess I just have a hard time like still positioning this in my mind. It's a bigger screen than the MacBook, but it's cheaper, but it's kind of better, but it's kind of worse.
Oh, I think performance wise, it's considerably better.
Then why is it cheaper?
Because it's less miniaturized. Well, so that's the thing, is they haven't updated the MacBooks, and I really don't know what this means for the rest of the line, but I'm not so sure they're committed to the MacBook anymore.
I am not one to typically put a bunch of emphasis on the naming, but the naming doesn't make sense to me anymore, because you would think that the Air would be the smallest, lightest, cheapest one. But that's the MacBook, you know? The MacBook is still the thinnest laptop possible, right? It's thinner than the MacBook Air.
Yes.
So the MacBook Air name doesn't really make sense to me anymore. It's just an update of this old thing that they still sell, so they need to make a new version of it.
Well, I think the conclusion we have to draw from that is that it's the brand name that is the most beloved and the most recognized. I mean, it's the best-selling one. People say MacBook Air all day long, and you see tons of them around. So they wanted to preserve this computer because it's one that people love. And, you know, Tim's introduction reached back to the introduction of the MacBook Air, which I remember vividly, when Steve Jobs pulled it out of an envelope. But that's not the selling point anymore. The point is, like, if people are buying a Mac, they know they need more computer than an iPad. If they wanted to get something that they could throw in their backpack, they know they could get an iPad, and they could also get an iPad for $350.
I position in my mind the MacBook as the beautiful one that people want to get if they care about a luxury product, and the MacBook Air as the one that they get if they're going to college.
Yes.
And I could be wrong about that, but that's kind of how it feels to me.
No, I think you're right. I really think that they might can the MacBook, honestly. I don't know where that computer has to go from here. They're not going to make it smaller, obviously, and it's really getting squeezed. So maybe this new MacBook Air represents a pivot, but like let's just like finish describing what we have here. So we have a Retina display with much better color. The worst thing about the MacBook Air before was the display, and that was why I couldn't rightly recommend it to people, because Mac needs a Retina display now. I'm fully on board with that, and so glad that the Air has one now. It has Touch ID, which they added as like a separate dedicated key. So there's no touch bar, and you've still got all of the security stuff that the touch bar computers have. The keyboard is the same third generation butterfly keyboard. I think that was a predictable thing, that they're using the same keyboard that they're using in the MacBook Pros, and people with their keyboard anxiety are gonna be upset about that, but they shouldn't be surprised. I doubt any of them will be. It has better speakers and microphones, which is good. The MacBook Air speakers were never great. In terms of ports, so the MacBook Air always had like just enough ports for me, I feel like. And now it's got two Thunderbolt 3 ports, which is better than one, you know? Of course, one is going to be used for charging, and you're still going to use dongles with this thing. But it's got two Thunderbolt 3 ports on the left side, and then a headphone port, and only a headphone port on the right side. The RAM capacity is doubled. You can get 16 gigs, up to 1.5 terabytes of storage in a computer this thin and light is pretty amazing. The battery life is the same. Nothing has improved in battery life on the entire Apple line except the iPhone XR. This is going to be the same battery life that you're used to, but the volume is 17% less than the previous 13-inch Air, which is crazy. And it's also a quarter pound lighter, so it's 2.75 pounds. The other things that are really exciting about this computer to me are, I mean, the only other thing that's really exciting to me about this computer is that it's made out of 100% recycled aluminum now. Apple's metallurgy team, first of all, Apple has a metallurgy team. Second of all, they've created a new alloy of aluminum that uses the shavings from their manufacturing process, boils it down atom by atom, and makes new aluminum out of it. So the MacBook Air is a 100% recycled computer with 50% fewer carbon emissions to manufacture. I think that's amazing.
It's pretty cool.
But then the last point on the price point, that was what we were all waiting for. We were waiting to see if they could still hit $999 or whatever, and they didn't. The 128 gig storage option starts at $1,199, which is the least expensive Mac notebook, as you said, but is more expensive. And The story that Apple can tell Wall Street now is that Apple hardware is getting more expensive. It's getting nicer. You're getting good value still, but there are no more cheap options.
Yeah, I mean, and I just looked it up and I was curious to see if they're still selling the old MacBook Air. And they are for $999?
That would be the existing price point. That would be what it was.
So they didn't knock the price down.
No, they're still selling the old one. But that's interesting. I didn't realize they would do that.
Yeah, and that to me kind of makes your point for you, to me, which is that they're not trying to beat a certain price, at least in my eyes.
Yeah.
They're happy with their price points, and they're happy with them being seen as high-end machines, and they're not trying to make a bargain for you.
So that's the MacBook Air. Which I will still recommend. This is an interesting way to talk about Apple recommendations at this point, especially when it comes to the Mac, I feel like, because the Mac has been in such limbo. The people in my life who want to upgrade their computers, the one conversation that I had about it in the last week with my mother-in-law was, I have a MacBook Air. I want to get a new computer. What should I do? And I told her to wait till today. And I'm really glad I did. They delivered exactly the machine that I was hoping they would deliver for a casual user who wants a Mac and knows she doesn't want an iPad. You know, I always try, you know, you could just get an iPad on everyone once to see what they say. And she said, no way, which is actually what, frankly, most of them say. So they delivered the MacBook Air that I wanted her to get. So she will be glad that I gave her that recommendation. So there was one more Mac announced today. It had been rumored that it would be announced. This, I think, is a relief to a certain subset of people. And it's a machine that I will admit to you right now, I have been interested in, which is a new Mac Mini. It had been years since there was a Mac Mini update. There was no reason to buy a Mac Mini. And now there is a slick space gray Mac Mini, which says everything about what the positioning of this is. It's no longer, I think that when the Mac Mini was introduced, it was introduced as a starter Mac. It was introduced for people who were Mac curious, but who thought Macs are too expensive, so I'm never going to get one. And they introduced this super inexpensive Mac that sits on your desk that you can plug into whatever display that you want. And now that's changed.
Well, and I think it was for people who already had a bunch of those components at a time where you didn't just go out and buy new components, right? Like,
yeah.
You might have had a PC with a display and a keyboard and a mouse, and now all of a sudden you could upgrade your tower to this little Mac Mini and have a Mac using all the same pieces that you had before, which now nobody cares about. I'm not going to save my display from 3 years ago. So there's kind of a whole new use for this Mac Mini, it seems like.
Well, I think there's one cohort that is saving their display from 3 years ago, which is people who bought a $2,000 display 3 years ago. In other words, professionals.
Yeah.
People who have like photo and video editing workflows that they don't want to interrupt, and they certainly don't want to drop thousands of more dollars on a display when they don't actually need the power of something like an iMac, let alone a Mac Pro, whenever that's coming. And so what they were waiting for was just a Mac Mini, a headless Mac with current generation specs. And that's what they got. And the finish, the space gray finish, I think is the obvious signal that Apple is positioning the Mac Mini now as a higher end product, a pro-oriented product rather than a starter product, because it's got the space gray finish, which is the way that the iMac Pro distinguishes itself. And they sell keyboards and trackpads in that space gray, and they're more expensive, which is, you know, another signal. So the Mac Mini now starts at 4 cores, and you can get 6. The improvement over the previous generation is 5 times faster processing, like computing power, because of how old the old Mac was, but also how good this one is. The previous one had up to 16 gigs, I'm not sure if this was a starting or high end feature or count, but 16 gigs was the old Mac Mini's memory capacity that they cited. Now it starts at 32 and goes up to 64. It's got all flash storage that's also 4 times faster, and it has capacity up to 2 terabytes. And the previous one had up to 1 terabyte, and I believe that was a spinning drive. So 2 terabytes of storage flash storage is also an indication of what this is for. Like, you can edit video on this thing.
I'm not typically one of those people to like to check out how expensive you can make a Mac, because I know the answer is always pretty expensive.
Yeah.
But I just looked at how much it costs to make that computer, and it's $4,000.
That's ridiculous. I don't know why you would do that. That's a pretty amazing spread of what's available for this Mac.
And to be fair, the typical computer that they would probably recommend is $1,000.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, that they're not asking you to get a $4,000 Mac Mini. But if you want to bump it up to the max, that's what you're paying. And again, this is, to me, so interesting that they're just not chasing a bottom line of a price point. They're pretty happy with whatever they're making, I guess. And
yeah.
Seem pretty confident that they're going to sell these things at whatever price they decide to sell them at.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that this redesign also reflects the fact that they're not going to sell that many of these. And so they want to get the most out of what they're going to sell. And they want the people who are buying them to get the most out of it that they possibly can. That's why they've shifted it towards the high end.
I'm looking at their page for it. And the use cases that they talk about are as a server, as a render farm, as a part of a live performance. So yeah, I mean, I don't see really anything here that's like showing a guy putting it on his desktop at his house and using it as his primary computer.
The sort of like idealized rendering of the device that they showed when they rolled it out was it sitting on a desk in front of a keyboard with a sort of reasonably sized display behind it. Wouldn't want for the quality of display that I would like my home computer to have, I'm not going to spend, you know, $1,000+ on a screen and around $1,000 on a separate Mac when I could get an iMac. I don't really see the home use that much, except for the one sort of nerdy home use, which I hear a lot of people use. And that's the one I'm curious about, but I'll be honest, I'm just curious about it because I'm aspirationally curious about it. I'm not going to do this. But a lot of people use Mac Minis at home headless as media servers. Mm-hmm. So if you had one just sort of hiding somewhere and you VNC'd into it from your laptop or your iPad, you know, I use screens on my iPad. I use screens on my phone all the time. Screens, which is a third-party app that lets you remotely log into your Mac and use it on an iOS device or a Mac. You know, I could easily imagine having a notebook and VNCing into a headless Mac Mini that had tons of internal storage and was like a backup and media server for the home type of use. But that's an extravagance, especially starting at $799, which is what this new Mac Mini starts at. But it's got the workhorse kind of outfit on the back for a device this small. I mean, it's got Ethernet, it's got 4 Thunderbolt 3 ports, 2 USB-A ports, and an HDMI port. So it's still like pretty versatile for various, kind of multimedia uses. But I don't think they're going to. I think what this is really for is for people who are going to rack a bunch of them and use them for parallel operations, editing video or whatever it is.
What I said to you when I saw the MacBook Air and Mac Mini being presented in this way is that it doesn't seem to me like Apple is really betting on the future of the Mac. And what I mean by that isn't that like these are bad products, but they're old products, you know? Like all of the Macs that they've made in recent years are updates to older Macs, which is not a bad thing at all. It just to me seems like their focus on creating new experiences is in iOS, and their focus in creating refined experiences is in macOS, which I think makes sense. It just, to me, is like where I'm going to be excited is in the new iPad, not in the new Mac.
They did do a sort of ground level walkthrough of what Mojave has as an OS update before they talked about these Macs.
It'll clean your desktop.
Yeah. And it was a pretty subtle thing. It was not like it wasn't a very splashy. It was the lowest energy part of the event. The Mac is here to be the good old Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they only talked about good old Macs this time. They really literally only did revisions to very old product lines on the Mac.
I don't think that Apple works as I don't think that Apple makes products as a response to what like the news is saying about them or what the press is asking for. Mm-hmm. But I do kind of feel like this is what the press has been asking for. And it bums me out because I am so interested in the Apple that like breaks things to create something new. And I feel like every time they've done that with the Mac, there's been all of this outrage. And they didn't do that today. And everybody, I bet, is going to be happy with it. But I'm just bored. And that's fine. Like, Apple doesn't have to make everything for me. And maybe they will make some stunning new Mac product that's totally different and radically, like, weird. But it just doesn't seem like that's what they're focusing on. And that just means that I won't be interested in Macs for a long time coming.
Well, it doesn't sound like you need them to be. They did make something for you today. They made your primary computer today.
Exactly.
So I think this is the right move. I'm pretty happy with what they're doing on the Mac side. And I do still, for now, care a lot about the Mac. I am not a very happy customer as a MacBook Pro user right now. And sort of, you know, I mean, I needed to bridge the gap between 2 years ago and now with a powerful computer. I'm glad that I've had this thing with me, but I would get this MacBook Air if I were still a MacBook Air user. I think I probably still should be a MacBook Air user. I think the thing that remains to be seen is whether I'm ever going to become an iMac user again since high school, you know, since the iMac was a giant plastic green bubble that I had on my desk. The question going forward, I think, is are they going to take away all of the use cases for a really powerful Mac for me? And the, you know, like, it does, I mean, you don't seem like you have any interest in a desktop Mac. Is that true?
If I could get rid of the few creative tasks that I require a MacBook for, or move them to the iPad, I would do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And I would never use this MacBook again.
Yep.
I'm currently staring at my MacBook Pro because it's how I have to record a podcast.
Right.
And I'm curious to know if I will be able to record a podcast on the iPad Pro in days to come.
We'll get to that. Let's fast forward. I do want to talk for a second about the retail thing. And I actually feel like we could really fall in a hole about this.
Yes, we could.
The interlude between the Mac announcements and the iPad announcement was an update from retail with Angela Ahrendts on stage. And all she talked about was new today at Apple sessions. And there are 60 new classes. And, you know, the kinds of examples, I knew that these existed. I knew that, like, you could go to your Apple store and do, like, Intro to GarageBand or whatever. But I didn't realize that there were photo walks where you go walk around exploring your city with people and you learn to take pictures using iPhone software features. The thing I got out of this announcement, and including the walkthrough of the Apple Store app, with the sessions tab, which is the middle tab of the toolbar now, where you can see like what today at Apple sessions are going on near you today, is that these are social gatherings that they're talking about. They're giving people stuff to do with other Apple enthusiasts, and the redesigns of the stores as town squares or whatever it was that they're calling them are to make them social hubs. Like physical world gathering places to do stuff with people. And it goes right along with this creativity theme, because it's not just, they're not just selling stuff to professional editors and content creators here. They're also saying for free, you can go learn to take photos on the phone you already have with other people, and you can meet them also. And Rene Ritchie on Twitter during the event made a very astute point, which is that this is part of the value proposition of buying Apple products. Like, yes, you're buying expensive devices, but then you get these free educational and technology training classes that you can go to whenever you want. And I would add that they double as hanging out with people. Maybe it's creepy that like the most profitable corporation on earth is becoming a cultural hub for its customers, that they want people to make their culture Apple culture. Like, there is something kind of strange about that. But at the same time, here we are, Drew, you know, making a show on Apple devices about Apple devices and the way we use them all the time. Like, it is our culture. And I would totally go learn to take photos.
Yeah.
And hang out with people who want to learn to take photos on an iPhone, because I know we would have a lot in common.
Yeah. The way that I described this when I saw this was that today at Apple, these new workshops, or whatever you're going to call them, experiences, are perhaps the most cultish thing that Apple has ever done.
Yep.
And if I was to work at Apple, I would put my full force behind them.
Yeah.
Because I think it's the best idea. And it's really shifting the way that you see Apple and turning it into, it's kind of a cringy word, but a lifestyle,
yep,
which is how it should be. And I feel like if you were to go to a workshop at Apple in days past, it would have been because you were an old person trying to figure out how to use your MacBook.
How does my email work?
Exactly. And they've shifted it to, oh, I'm going to now teach you how to use this creative tool in a way that you didn't know you could. And I think I might have brought this up on a show before, but I had to go to an Apple store maybe a year ago, and it was the first time that they were really getting this off the ground. And I saw all of these kids learning how to program a little computer robot droid thing to like follow a path that they had taped down on the floor.
Wow.
And there were all these dads and moms and kids who were having such a fun time while I was there to like replace my iPhone. And I thought, oh man, like I haven't realized how much being only going to the Genius Bar has made me not enjoy the Apple Store, where now there's this whole new group of people who see the Apple Store as a place for fun, not a place for fixing something bad you've done.
Yep.
And that's so smart. What I would say is that my only criticism here is that it's still so heavily attached to retail. And I would love to see basically a Today at Apple store where the sales part was secondary and the workshops or experiences or whatever were primary. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that in the future. Would you?
No. I mean, it seems like they're redesigning the stores and designing the new stores in that direction already. I mean, I don't think they're going to get rid. I doubt they will ever get rid of the floor sales of devices. But it's mostly because so many Apple devices require you to walk up to them and touch them and use them.
Right.
My mom got a Series 4 Apple Watch. I'm so excited that there's someone else in my family who's an Apple Watch user now. But she needed to go to the store and put it on and see. And I think that that's a really important part of learning how the things work too, is the first impression. I'm not sure that they will diversify the line of stores, but I definitely see them redesigning the stores already as like places that are nice to gather in, and you know, with places to sit together around a screen and learn. That's floor space they're not using to sell products already, and that really says something, because I think retail, it's not an industry I know a ton about, but my understanding is that but at the end of the day, retail companies are weighed on how much money per square foot per hour their stores make. Mm-hmm. And Apple is devoting tons of real estate in their stores, not directly to selling products. And I think that seems to be sort of the mission that Angela Ahrendts has been on since she joined the company. And it's fascinating. It's almost a relief. And I realize that it is all marketing for Apple stuff at some point, but at the same time, you know, these products are so expensive. People are like, is it really worth the money? Am I really getting that much more of an experience from paying for this thing? And like, if you're just looking at the statistics of how the device performs, maybe not. But if you're seeing it as like a potential community building thing that's like built in for free, like, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that that's what this is.
I think it really fits so well in this era where everything can be learned from YouTube, because learning everything from YouTube is possible, but it's a pretty bad experience.
Yeah.
And you really got to do a lot of digging to find out everything you want to learn. And it's going to take you a lot longer than you wish it would.
Yep.
And being able to link the product that you've purchased to learning is just such a great idea to me.
Okay, it's time. Let's talk about the iPad, the most popular computer in the world.
Is that really? Yeah, I mean, I feel so weird about that because, and maybe it's just, you know, the people that I follow on Twitter are kind of constantly like ragging on it, but I always feel like I'm such a minority for using the iPad, but that's obviously not true. That's a weird thing about Apple, isn't it, that we've talked about before, is that you always feel like the underdog.
Yeah.
And it's often not the case.
No, it's like key to the Apple story is like, so many of us remember when that was truly the case.
Yeah.
When like the evil empire of Microsoft ruled the world and only the brave, colorful Apple people stood between the world and like absolute tyranny. And so now Apple's the most profitable company on earth, but they're still relying on generating this feeling. And like, I haven't ever considered, and I'm not seriously considering now, but I like the idea that the reason why Apple is pushing the iPad and the Mac simultaneously is to create two classes of underdogs.
It does really work.
That is kind of what's happening.
That's so strange.
The way that Tim Cook presented this idea of the iPad as the most popular computer in the world was in contrast to other PC manufacturers. He dismissed the idea of comparing the iPad to other tablets. Like, there are no other tablets. This has been true the whole time. The market for tablets is like 80-90% iPads or something like that. But then he put other laptop manufacturers. Actually, I can't remember if it was all, well, I mean, it must have been all computers, like all models combined, made by every other computer manufacturer, and the iPad sold more last year than any other. So yeah, I mean, people are ragging on the iPad, I think, because it does, because it doesn't hold a candle to the iPhone in terms of popularity. Mm-hmm. But that's obviously the wrong comparison. And also, it's obvious, I think, that the 329 starter level iPad must have helped. Going into this iPad Pro announcement, what we have come to understand is that this is a form factor redesign of the most popular computer in the world. And my goodness, what a redesign. I mean, they like to say this every time they do a major hardware redesign, but the guy who came out said, this is what we wanted the iPad to be from the beginning. And it's so exciting that we're getting to that point with so many devices at once. Because obviously the Series 4 Apple Watch is what they wanted it to be from the beginning. The iPhone 10 is, you know, they will say is like, this is the ideal of the iPhone. I think that's only going to be true once the notch is gone.
Yeah.
But basically, like, of course, you know, a screen, nothing but screen is what the ideal form factor for an Apple device is. And now all of the major product lines have that.
This is a tablet.
Yep.
Like, right, the most perfect version of a tablet that you could get at this point. And I love it for that.
There's so many things that I love about this design. The squared off edges, first and foremost, the sort of iPhone 4 style, like flat edge, instead of the sort of half rounded edges with the sharp top that they've had before. The screen, though, obviously is the biggest improvement. Like, already, even before I got an iPhone 10, the corners on my iPad started to look barbaric to me. Just like that, right, that like, right, hard edge to the screen with just black, empty nothingness. That's different widths on different sides. Like, it looked like my screen was squeezed in. And now it goes all the way to the edge with the rounded corners. It's using the same technology, the same Liquid Retina screen, and the same pixel masking in the corners and anti-aliasing to prevent like jagged lines on the curves as the iPhone XR, which is something that I texted to you as they were announcing the XR last month. I was pretty sure that that's why that phone exists, because the iPhone X and XS line, the OLED iPhone, marches on as like the new experimental screen technology. Well, it's not experimental anymore, but, you know, it's the new screen technology. But then when they announced the lower cost iPhone that had a new advanced kind of LCD screen instead of just the same old iPhone screen, my immediate thought was the only reason they could only be doing this whole iPhone XR, this whole like almost premium device designed around this new edge to edge LCD screen, has to be because this screen technology is more fundamental to them than that. And so I'm not at all surprised to see it roll out on the iPad Pro and be the same Liquid Retina concept.
I'll be very curious to see this in person, because it's a markedly different look than the iPhone X. It doesn't really look at all like it to me. I mean, obviously there's the similarity of a small bezel and rounded screen corners, but it's got a more bubbly shape. Uh-huh. I don't really know how to describe it. Than the iPhone 10 does.
It's its own thing, for sure. It doesn't look like an iPhone 10 iPadified, which is kind of what I was imagining.
Me too.
But I bet you the experience is going to feel like that. There are a couple more things that they mentioned that I'll blast through. The multi-core performance of the A12X Bionic is 90% faster than the existing iPad Pro, which is so insane. They're still almost doubling how powerful iPads are when they upgrade them. I might have missed something, but it sounded like he said that the graphics performance is 1,000 times faster. Like, I don't know if I must have. Maybe it was 1,000%. But like, that the comparison he said was that the iPad is now as good at graphics as an Xbox, but it's 90% smaller and runs on battery. So that's pretty awesome as people who use iPads to play games, as we have detailed at length on this show.
Yeah, let's get some graphic upgrades in PUBG.
Just launching it on my 10S, I've seen how much better the graphics are on my phone than on my iPad, so I'm pretty excited for that. The battery life has not, like, just like before, like I mentioned with the MacBook Air, the battery life is the same all day, quote unquote, same all day battery life as what we're used to. So, you know, no improvements there. The big other change to this device is that it is now USB-C. So this is a huge deal, I think. And it instantly made all of the dongles I've bought for my Mac twice as valuable. You know, like I now have a dongle that I can already use that has a USB-C, USB-A, and HDMI port that I could plug into my iPad all at once, which means I could plug in power and plug in audio equipment or whatever. The thing I'm really interested to see is whether I can plug in my podcasting mic that I'm using right now directly to my iPad, and I bet you I can. And here's why. I don't know that for sure, but the reason why I think so is that the iPad now offers power out. You can plug your phone into your iPad and charge your phone. And that is so sweet. And like, I mean, I that to me, that means it has to be the case that you can plug a powered mic in by USB-C. If you can do it to a Mac, you have to be able to do it to an iPad. Like, I will be outraged if it's not the case. But it seems very promising to me because they listed all these things, cameras, musical instrument. He said musical instruments. If you can plug a musical instrument in, and microphone counts.
That's true. That's true.
You know, other kinds of docks for, you know, all kinds of, you know, photo, video production things, and even 5K displays. You can plug your iPad into a monitor now. And it's all because it's using USB-C. That also means you can do the same fast charging that you can do for a Mac. I bought the 30-watt USB-C brick charger for the iPad separately because I can imagine wanting to charge this sucker up real fast if I need to.
Yep.
I also bought the USB-C to headphone jack adapter just in case, you know, I don't know. It's only $9. Although it's $9. So maybe that was dumb, but, you know, somebody will need it at some point. To me, the really big question is, are they going to get rid of Lightning? Are they going to move the iPhone to USB-C also?
I don't know. I don't know if USB-C is good enough for that.
Well, it's good enough for the iPad.
I guess it is if everyone's using wireless charging.
Well, right. Exactly. The port is increasingly becoming a way to expand an iOS device into a more powerful tool and less about charging.
Yeah. I just don't think that the port is as good as Lightning for charging. So I can't imagine that they want to move everything over and have the bad press of, oh, everyone has to buy new cables again and Lightning's obsolete, just like they did with the 30-pin dock, even though it had been around for like a solid decade.
Now they're offering the iPad Pro in four sizes, 64, 256, 512, and 1 terabyte. And the pricing isn't surprising, I guess. The 11-inch starts at $799 for 64 gigs. The 12.9 starts at $999 for 64 gigs. But the price increase is pretty dramatic. I mean, it's $150 to go to 64 to 256. It's $200 more to go from 256 to 512. And then it's $400 more dollars to go from 512 to 1 terabyte. So
not worth it.
That is not worth it at all. I went for 512.
I went for 256, man.
Yeah.
I'm just not the storage guy that you are, which is probably telling of the kinds of things that we do with our devices and what kind of stuff we like to keep local.
Yeah.
But basically every year for a good while now, I've just looked at my device and seen how much space I had free. And I currently have the 256 gig iPad and I have 100 gigs free.
Yeah.
So I think I'll be A-okay keeping it at that level.
Yeah.
And I have the 256 iPhone too. Mm-hmm. So that seems like more than enough space for me to not ever run out of stuff. I have 200 gigs available on the iPhone 10.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to stick with 256.
Yep. So I have the, so like I said, my iPad is 256 and I can only download one or two movies to bring with me on a plane or whatever. And the device is full. Yeah. So it's obvious that I need to go up. Like I said, the iPhone at 256 is less than half full. And I think that, at 512 is less than half full. So I think that's going to be plenty for me. Cellular.
Oh yeah.
Or not. Oh, yeah. So I've 100%. Never had a cellular iPad before and I decided to go for it this time, because I love having a separate cellular, you know, it's really funny. People have long recommended, like, why would you not get the cellular? It's foolish not to, like, why not give yourself the capability if you want it? And I've always been, you know, my response has always been, oh, I can just tether to my phone. It's no big deal. And two things have happened to convince me that that's not the right move. One is the LTE on the iPhone has gotten so freaking fast that I've started to realize how much slower a tethered device is than one that's directly connected to LTE, because it's become so frustrating to tether my iPad to my phone that I just will use the phone instead because of how much faster the connection is. So like that limitation is being clearly made, that's being clearly demonstrated to me. But then also having an LTE watch that works independently of my phone has been so fun that I can imagine going out with my iPad and my watch and not my phone. Like, I know how weird that sounds, but if I was just going to a cafe down the street, I can totally imagine doing that.
Right.
And I want to be able to use the iPad that way.
Having cell service on the iPad is part of the secret sauce for me.
Yeah.
Being able to open it up at any time, anywhere around the world, since I have T-Mobile, which works basically anywhere.
Yeah.
And being able to be connected to the internet without having to go to the coffee shop and get the Wi-Fi password or whatever is just so nice.
Yeah.
It just means that I can start working on something with literally nothing stopping me from doing it immediately. There's no logging in. There's no waiting for it to boot. There's no waiting for it to connect to Wi-Fi. It just happens.
Yep.
And that's part of why I love the iPad so much. So I have to get them with cellular every single time.
Yeah. Also, I have no hesitation about going for the largest size available and trying it on as sort of my primary device. And I think that both for the iPad itself objectively and for me personally, today represents a sort of shift in the centrality of the iPad in the digital life of the Apple user and customer.
Yeah.
And I know that you've made this shift already, that you sort of consider the iPad your primary computer. Is that fair to say?
Totally.
And I still don't. I still think of it as sort of an extension of all of the stuff I'm doing and all of the stuff I'm watching and reading and playing and whatever into its most sort of portable large format. But I still think of the Mac on my desk as my hub, as my home, if you will. And I really think that this new iPad Pro is going to allow me to start to shift that for myself.
Tell me why.
Well, I think that there still are some shoes that need to drop as far as iOS goes. I think that there are a few, like here, like basically the one thing that's holding me back now is multitasking within apps. The one thing I do every day on my Mac that I use in my daily workflow that makes me more efficient at what I do, to the point that it makes it possible, I think, to do what I do, is that I have multiple windows of the same app. So multitasking within the same app is really the difference for me between doing my work on my Mac and sort of accessing my work on an iPad.
Yeah.
And there are workarounds for certain kinds of work when you're working in a file type, for example, that you can edit in multiple apps. Like if I'm working in a text file, I can deal with that. I can use two different apps to work on two different text files at once. But that's not an ideal solution. And most of the time, that's not what I'm doing. I'm mostly working in, I mean, the one key example would be OmniFocus. The way I use OmniFocus on the Mac is not by sort of quickly switching between views like you do in the iOS app, but actually by having focused task lists for each area of work I'm doing that are on different spaces on the Mac.
Yeah.
So like my Burning Man project tasks are in a little narrow strip that only shows Burning Man stuff on one desktop, and my home domestic tasks are on another desktop, and I switch between those spaces. Now, that's not a very that there is a way in which that's a very iOS style way of working, swiping between full screen workspaces instead of having like a ton of windows open on a single space, right? Because like that's how multitasking works on the iPad now.
Right.
But I can't have a different OmniFocus window open in each of those spaces. So that's really the only OS change that I would need. But the thing is, that's the only one. And it seems pretty plausible as something we might see in June.
I was pretty positive that I wouldn't be interested in the larger version of the iPad Pro, but turns out that they made the bezel small enough and they made the screen the right size where I think it's perfect. And it's already, by the way, available for sale, and I've already purchased it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. To me, like, I wasn't expecting to be so interested in changing the screen size, but I mean, what really sold me on this new iPad is the promise of companies like Adobe to actually bring desktop class software to iOS, quote unquote, finally.
Yeah.
Because that's what it's been missing from my experience. And, you know, you brought up the multitasking thing, and there are still some times where it's much easier for me to pull out my MacBook and use it. Yesterday was a great example of that. I'm currently in this major renovation project, and I was getting multiple invoices from contractors, and I was trying to figure out numbers, and I had a PDF here and another PDF here and an email here, and I had to open basically every single one of those at the same time and look at them side by side by side by side. Uh-huh. And I needed a MacBook to do that. It would have been really cumbersome to have done that on an iPad Pro. But that wasn't the iPad Pro's fault. That was life's fault, right? But at the same time, you want a computer that can deal with life.
That's a funny way of putting it. And you're right. Yeah. Ultimately, yes. The computer's job is to deal with life.
Yeah. Because, you know, there are all these incredible, beautiful videos of how people use the iPad Pro, but like they're not dealing with when somebody sends you like an OpenDoc file from 2006 and you're like, well, now what do I do here? You know, and like a desktop, a Mac computer can handle all of those things really well, where an iPad still fumbles. But all that being said, my experience using an iPad is so much better than my experience using a Mac. And that's, I was going to say that's personal preference, and I will still say that, but honestly, I don't believe it. I think that the iPad experience is objectively better than the Mac experience at this time because of all the little things it does so well that I am so happy to forgive it for the times when it can't handle the clunky ways of computing that we've had to get used to because other people are still using them.
Yeah, I agree on the experience point. That's the thing. You know, the other thing that happened is that I got the new iPhone
right
paradigm. Like I now have an all screen iPhone, and having to interact using any input method that isn't on the screen has started to become barbaric for me. Like I can't, like it takes me 2 minutes to adjust to using Ariel's iPhone 8, which is a phone that I was using until 2 months ago. You know, like I have forgotten how to use indirect input methods in a handheld form factor. And so the idea that the gestures now are all going to be the same and the way and Face ID is there and all of that, like I'm interested to see if that quality of life improvement that I've gotten from that direct edge-to-edge interaction with what's on screen is going to dramatically improve the way that I experience that day-to-day stuff.
Totally.
And it's possible that even though there's so much of the multitasking stuff on Mac that I still feel like I need, it may be outweighed by just how much more intuitive it is for me to deal with the stuff that's right there. And maybe like multitasking isn't so good for the brain or something, you know, maybe I'll figure out other ways of doing it.
That's how I feel. I don't feel like you need more than three windows open at a time, which is possible with an iPad Pro.
Right.
And I am happy to have that constriction. It's why I much prefer writing on an iPad Pro, because I just have this one big window open and nothing else to distract me. One of the things that I do the most creatively on this iPad Pro is edit podcasts like this one that we're recording right now. And having as much screen as possible and as little bezel as possible is really, really good for doing things like that. And this new Apple Pencil is really intriguing to me because I love doing things like editing the podcast with an Apple Pencil, but the few little constrictions of the pencil, the first generation pencil, have made it so that I often don't pull it out just because I'm lazy. Mm. Like, oh, well, it's probably not charged, so it'd take, you know, 5 minutes to charge it, which is nothing, but I'd rather just start editing the podcast right now with my finger.
Yeah. I've told myself several times in the course of thinking through what's going to happen here that I'm not going to get it because I already have a pencil that works fine. So I think I'm going to hold myself to that, because as I'm looking at Apple.com right now, I'm realizing that the storage options are a lot more expensive than I was expecting, and that this thing is really going to pack a punch as in terms of how expensive it is to get. It's going to cost like a primary computer amount of money.
It is.
So I think that what I'm going to do is still use my existing pencil and try and make myself do more creative work on the device and see if I could actually justify getting a new one. Because I did edit a podcast the last week. I don't know if it's a podcast that will ever be publicly released. It was sort of like a trial run of a new idea with someone else. And I edited it in Logic on my Mac, and it was brutal. It was painstaking.
It's so bad.
I'm really interested to try that kind of thing on an iPad. And like I said to you during the keynote, I've never really learned to use Photoshop before. Like, I've tried to. And I need to sometimes, but I'm like totally a hack at it. And there's like many things that I've totally given up on that I could have finished if I had been adept at Photoshop. And it's all because of the controls. It's all because of the
right.
Inscrutable, tower of menu items in Photoshop on the desktop and all the obscure keyboard shortcuts and, you know, right click options and all that stuff. And what I said to you during the keynote was, if I could touch the screen, I might be able to figure out how to use Photoshop finally. So, I think that I still have to prove to myself that this is true, but I'm much more convinced by the capabilities on offer now, that it's possible to get real, to do real creative work on this as a primary computer.
I am super excited about the Adobe announcement. And that was really, I think I messaged you saying like, come on, Adobe, give us something really good here.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the things that's been holding people back from the iPad. I have a friend of mine who's an amazing graphic designer, one of the best creatives I know, and he doodles quite often on the iPad, loves doodling on the iPad Pro that he owns, but he doesn't do quote unquote real work on it because there isn't programs that really allow him to do the kind of work that he does. And also, he's been using programs on the desktop for quite a while and is very used to them on macOS. So why would you transition to a like lesser experience on the iPad to try to do the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
And this announcement of what they actually called real Photoshop, which I love that they called that on the stage, basically admitting that the things that they've been producing up until this point weren't real.
Yeah.
What they showed on the stage is so incredible, not only because of how powerful it is, but because it's this new opportunity for people like you to learn something that's become so confusing in its current form. And this is actually quite similar to my own experience editing video. I only really learned how to edit video, which is one of the primary things I've done for work for the last decade, because Final Cut Pro 10 came out right when I was really getting interested in it. And right before it had come out, I had been trying to learn Final Cut 7, I believe, is the one that they had before 10.
Yeah, I think that's
and
right.
And Adobe Premiere. In both of those programs were so confusing to me, I had completely given up on learning how to edit video. But because they came out with this new stripped down version of the program, I was totally able to learn it from scratch. And I have become incredibly adept at doing it. And, you know, this is the problem with some of these programs that have been around for so long that are relied on by so many creatives, is that they're buried under 20 to 30 years of features built on top of features built on top of features. And if you're coming into it as somebody brand new, it just looks totally confusing, like a total mess.
Yeah.
And my hope, and it really seemed to be from what I saw of the demo, is that this new version of Photoshop is truly like a new version of Photoshop that'll feel so intuitive to use to anyone who's trying to create using this program. And that's like so fascinating to me, that the iPad Pro is not only going to be a great place for me to do design work, but it's probably going to become the place that a whole new generation of designers learns how to design. And that is so great. I love it.
Yeah. The idea that what you see when you start it up is the thing you're there to work on, that completely takes over your device, rather than, you know, a bunch of menus and a welcome screen and all the stuff that you're going to expect on a
Mac.
It makes it more like, I think this is a theme that we've talked about before, like maybe in the previous, in the education event when the cheap iPad came out, the idea that this is approaching more and more like a real world device, a real world tool where you're working on real things. It's getting as close to that as digital media and content and software can possibly get.
And the fun thing is that with this iPad, you can do things that you could never do on a desktop. The one that they chose to show off on stage is this new AR feature, Photoshop Files, which I was on the fence whether or not it was gimmicky or interesting. So I went ahead and asked my designer friend what he thought of it, and he was blown away by the ability for him to look at a Photoshop design file in real life. And he said that the nice thing about it is that he could use it as essentially a physical installation when he does mockups for a client of something in the real world. And I hadn't really thought about how nice that would be to be able to design something and then see it on the wall or on a table, you know, without having to really do too much work to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's going to be a really unique way of showcasing your work. And I think that that's something that you could have never done on the desktop, and you can only really do with a device like the iPad.